Today on CyberWork, I'm joined by a very special co-host. InfoSec CEO Jack Koziel joins me to meet BlackBerry's Eric Milam to discuss his team's work on the massive research project about the threat actor group Bahamut. Eric discusses how their research found connections within a group that targets everyone from Indian oil tycoons to Middle Eastern government officials, skills that his research team had to have to do the work, and what the dinner table conversations are like when you're aggressively pursuing a nation-state attack group. Remember that CyberWork listeners are eligible for a free month of InfoSec skills by going to infosecinstitute.com/skills and using the code CyberWork when joining. That's 30 days of free security courses, hands-on cyber ranges, skills assessments, and certification practice exams, all when you use the promo code CyberWork on signup. That's infosecinstitute.com/skills. And now, let's begin the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends are affecting the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. In October of 2020, BlackBerry published an extensive game-changing report about the massive threat actor group Bahamut, targeting Indian oil tycoons, Middle Eastern government officials, and Qatari, Kashmiri, and Sikh political groups. Bahamut stands in a field of its own due to its unnervingly precise and targeted attacks and the deep web of seemingly real and very convincing content that draws its targets into a web of what BlackBerry Report calls, quote, a vast fake empire of malicious traps. Today's guest, Eric Milam, is the VP of Research Operations at BlackBerry, where he and his team track malware threats and threat actors. During his time at BlackBerry, he discovered and published the details of numerous emerging threats and malware variants actively being exploited in the wild. Prior to joining BlackBerry, Eric was a highly regarded penetration tester and frequent conference speaker, widely known for his red teaming exploits. In addition, we have another special guest on CyberWork, InfoSec founder and CEO Jack Koziel. Jack has a special interest in the findings of this report, so we are both going to talk to Eric about different aspects of the group findings, and Jack is going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of the findings, while I talk with Eric about the work of the people who put the report together and how that type of high-level cybersecurity investigation could be something as a career path for cybersecurity newcomers to study and aspire to. Eric and Jack, thank you for joining me today on CyberWork. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Chris.
So I want to start right at the very beginning because, I've been following this story a little bit, but, you know, I didn't know all the details. So just to sort of set the table here, how did the Bahamut group appear on your radar, Eric? Did you start seeing sort of interconnections between these similar attacks, or were they already known to you as an entity when you started researching?
Yeah, for this research, we already knew. We actually started tracking Bahamut around 2018.
Okay.
We did when we were Silence, before we were purchased by BlackBerry, we did research. Operation Shaheen was the report, and we called the threat actor the White Company. Mm-hmm. And it was a three-part series around that. And so what we came to find out, obviously, is as you continue to research, pull on strings, follow breadcrumbs, we started to understand that the White Company was actually the Bahamut, right? And additional threat actors that were referenced in other research also was Bahamut. So we were able to kind of put all that together into a single place as we looked through all these different TTPs and back-end command and control, and we're able to kind of put that together and say, hey, wait, these are all the same groups.
Yeah, right? So it was at that point when you sort of realized the sort of size and scope of this project and decided to make it this sort of ongoing process?
Yeah, I mean, so we're always tracking large threat actors. We're doing our best to try to stay in front of, you know, global exploits that are happening. This one, obviously, since there's been a lot of research on this group and the fact that, you know, they have such disparate kind of attacks against disparate targets that wouldn't normally be connected together seems extremely interesting, right? And being able to look at those and tie those together is always fascinating, right? When you see two things that appear to be at the opposite end of the spectrum, you might not understand why they're being attacked by a certain group all the time, but it was interesting to see how that they were, right? So,
Eric, do you think there's other different threat actor groups out there that are Bahamut but just haven't been attributed yet? Like, do you have a sense of how much we actually know about the full scale of their operations?
I mean, so do I believe we have a full sense? I don't think so, right? I think that, you know, I imagine this is like a corporation, like any other corporation, where they're hired by entities, right? And they go and they have their business meetings and they plan out. We're actually doing research right now that's going to be released in a couple of weeks, and we believe that this is also part of Bahamut. We couldn't make the direct connection, but it's also a mercenary, you know, hack for hire type situation in the same kind of region. So yeah, I think that they have a lot of ongoing projects. I think they have a lot of customers, I guess, if you want to use that term. And I think that, you know, with the rise of like ransomware as a service, phishing as a service, it makes sense. Obviously that hacking as a service makes sense. As you guys know, attribution's hard, and the more you can diversify, or a state actor can diversify into a company that they trust or an entity that they trust, they're probably going to do that.
So. Yeah, I mean, the scope and sophistication of the Bahamut Group's attacks is pretty staggering. And as you said, there's a very wide reach, but it doesn't feel wild style at all. Like, it's very targeted. You know, there's these exact spear phishing campaigns and these fully operational and realistic websites full of, you know, fraudulent news and malicious apps and what you guys called a vast fake empire designed to draw in its high value targets. So like in your research, what were your first steps in trying to get a full picture of the reach and scope of the group and their attacks?
Yeah. I mean, I think once we had like a foothold, once we kind of understood what we were looking for, we just started pulling strings. I know that the report mentions not just the website, but the, you know, the mobile applications and things like that. And I think, as you mentioned, like their tradecraft is exceptional.
Yes.
They really, and this is another thing that lets you know they're highly, highly trained, because they know what their target is. They know what they're going after, and they're patient in getting it. This is not a smash and grab. This isn't, you know, I'm going to send a bunch of stuff out and hope I get something. This was highly targeted. And the fact that it's easy to see that, I mean, even down to, you know, not just the websites that we explained there, but even the EULAs that they used in the mobile apps say exactly what's going to happen, and people still accepted it, right? it's really interesting, right? That they, like I said, they really know what they're doing. There's definitely was some missteps along the way. I don't want to give all of them away,
right?
But like the back end, like the application's talking the same command and control. So once we were able to identify a command and control server or something that we knew was associated with this threat actor, we could start kind of tying that together to say, okay, these are all talking to this, right? This is all talking to this backend command and control. So we know, even if, you know, we look at this and say, you know, on the face, it doesn't look like it, the backend communications were very clear.
Okay.
Plus the encryption algorithm that they used and all those types of things in communication. So,
yeah. Hey, Eric, I don't know if you can talk to this specifically or more generally, but what sort of counter investigation practices did Bahamut take while your team was investigating them over this time? I mean, were there any real surprising things there that led you to say, wow, this is quite a sophisticated adversary we're working against, or anything specific you can share there?
What I would say is, like, they were really adept at changing. I think once they realized that they are being viewed, right? And I'm not going to say there was anything that necessarily stood out, but they're really good at standing up and tearing down their backend infrastructure and making changes. So again, it's clear that they have this, they have a contingency plan or a disaster recovery plan or whatever you want to call it, like any other corporation would have. I mean, they're really set up to be, you know, successful on their end. So those types of things are really interesting, because the way in which they mimic how we also, right, in the corporate world and government go about protecting ourselves. They had all that in place, as if they had clear knowledge or training in those areas as well.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's like they built like a business statement or a statement of purpose or whatever. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty interesting point there. I guess, do you have any concept of how many Bahamut employees, you know, kind of what their estimates of what their revenue base is, or, I mean, are there any, is there anything you can publicly share about that?
There's definitely breadcrumbs that we've left. I think it's easy to get to where people need to get to if they review the report and other researchers dig into it. You know how it is with researchers. We publish what we're comfortable with. We publish what we can ascertain 100%, right? That's what we're comfortable with.
Sure.
And then we hope that this research furthers other research, right? Like, we weren't the first ones, obviously, to look into them. And this is the second time as a company we looked into them. So, I think that it might, you know, other researchers or in the future, we might be able to uncover that. But right now, we don't have a full breadth of that. Okay. But I can tell you, a lot of stuff we're finding, especially in that region, Southeast Asia, is looking like it's tying back to that specific group. So they're a pretty big player, would be my guess.
So when I think of, you know, you saying like they've created this huge sort of, you know, empire of content, like, do you have a sense of whether, you know, everyone who's creating materials for Bahamut strikes is actually sort of in the group, or are they using kind of like third party vendors? You know, because I also manage InfoSec resources here. We do a daily blog of like cybersecurity content. Do you have a sense of whether like there are people who are unaware that the material that they're working on is actually being used in these sort of Bahamut things? Or do you think everything that's sort of like used in these, you know, fake websites and so forth is coming from people who are sort of, you know, down for the cause or whatever?
Yeah. So that, obviously that's an interesting question, right? Do they have, third party contractors working on their back end infrastructure and things like that?
Cause it's so realistic, you know?
Yeah. I honestly, in my opinion, right, would be no. I think that they're just, they have the right people. They know what their tradecraft is. Operational security is something that they take very, very seriously. So I doubt that they would want to have, more people in the mix. Now, maybe it happens. I can't tell you with 100% accuracy that someone else might be tied to it, but I would think, knowing this group and knowing how pedantic they are, that they wouldn't want to bring too many people in that might spoil that.
Gotcha. So how are
you? Know,
go ahead.
Sorry, Chris. There was a Reuters reporter who was doing a little bit of follow-on research, like you mentioned, after after the BlackBerry published the research, and it was pretty interesting.
Raphael. Okay.
Yeah. He published some links to, he went back and dug out some of the fake news websites that they created, and dug out really interesting a video that they created that specifically was targeted towards an incident about the Golden Temple. It was shocking I had assumed that this stuff would be, you could very much identify it as fake just looking at it. But I mean, if I didn't know that this was made by Bahamut, I would have just thought it was, you know, someone else on the internet out there. And I guess, I don't know, just from your perspective, maybe more personally, is how much can you really trust or anything that you see or read on the internet when you can see that a group like this can produce such high quality, you know, I don't even want to call it fake news, but I mean, call it like, you know, fake informational resources out there.
Yeah. No, I mean, so I did an interview a couple of months ago on deepfakes, right? And the technology behind that. And, you know, it's mind blowing. My favorite one so far is where they put in, I think, Tom Holland and I can't believe I'm missing his name. Who's the guy who plays Iron Man?
Oh, Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. into Back to the Future as Marty McFly and Doc Brown. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but it looks legit. Like you're saying, the technology and the power to do this is now in the hands of everybody. And so when you look at somebody like Bahamut, who's a motivated actor, right, who's probably being paid a lot of money to do this and has the resources to do it, like you said, I mean, what is to separate reality from fantasy? Because perception is reality, right? Everybody's perception is their own reality. So If you can convince them with that, yeah, you know, it is, it's kind of frightening.
So, yeah, totally. It's, I guess, on a little bit of a tangent here, but talking about deepfakes and, you know, content that's being released, what's your opinion on the recent Biden, you know, laptop release and all of the content on there? I mean, do you have an opinion of, I mean, I don't want to get political or anything, but, but just more like from a technical, from someone who's knows more about this than probably almost every human on the planet. Like, what's your perspective on that?
I mean, my question is, non-repudiation of the chain of custody. I don't think we have that. So how can you say where it came from or who did it or whatever, right? You know, signatures can be faked. Laptops can be dropped off with accounts created on them. You know, you can go out to the dark web and probably find a bunch of accounts for me, right? And you could set those up on a laptop, right? In fact, one interesting thing that I'll bring up is after this report was released a couple weeks later, someone got into like my Wayfair account and ordered 30 sink faucets, like $10,000, tried to order $10,000 worth of stuff. Wow. And that's bad on me for having an old account with a crazy password. But like those things do happen, right? They happen to even like security professionals like us, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, my main thing in that whole thing is non-repudiation of the chain of custody. We don't have that. So you can't say that it came from a certain person.
Right.
Now, if they do have that and that comes out, I haven't seen that in the news. But if they have that, then sure, that's a big deal. But somebody handing somebody a laptop and saying it came from somebody, that's not chain of custody.
Right? Yeah. I think the world's going to change as, you know, people that are very involved in the cyber industry, like we're aware of deepfakes and all the things that can be happening. But the vast majority of people don't understand or don't have any concept of this. So it's, you know, it's just got to wait for society to catch up, I guess.
Right.
When Anderson Cooper's talking about it, my grandma understands it, then I know that we'll be there. Like that's what WannaCry was, right? For ransomware.
There you go.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, so, so jumping back to the research project here, I want to sort of get a sense of the scope of your staff of researchers compiling this report. Like, what type of tasks did they need to do to get all this information into the research document? And did any of them have to go into fairly dangerous places on the internet to sort of do their fact finding?
Yeah, I mean, so interestingly enough, you know, you would think that there'd be an army of folks working on this, and right. So. For what we call our threat hunting and intelligence team, our SPEAR team, there's really only 10 people, and two people worked on this project. So, so you have a threat hunter researcher digging in and doing all the research. Then you have a threat intelligence person kind of, you know, coordinating, amalgamating all this data into a more robust story, right? So, you know, the geopolitical aspects, you know, location type stuff. And so normally when we do work on these, we normally have two people and then maybe a tech writer working on it together or a threat intel writer to try to pull this stuff together. As far as going into dangerous places, you know, not in this case. I mean, most of the stuff is hiding in plain sight, right?
Okay.
You know, the C2s are publicly available, you know, and that's mostly how it goes. You find a lot of stuff just in, you know, like places like VT or other repositories, and you start or Shodan even, and you go and you just start pulling the strings on those and see where it takes you. But most of it's publicly available. It's actually pretty interesting how much is just right there if you look.
Yeah, just waiting for someone to actually read the fine print.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, you know, how much stuff actually does show up on VT that, you know, people put up there. And then 3 or 4 months later, you might have a hit in your, you know, in your threat intel platform from some other hunting you did that connects the dots. And then you're off to the races, right? So,
So that sounds like the coolest job in all of cybersecurity is these two people that get to do all this kind of work. Like, can you tell us a little bit more about their backgrounds and just, career journey of, I mean, I imagine most listeners on this, like on this podcast, like this is a career aspiration to get to be working on your team or something like that. Like how do they, can you tell us just about their journeys and just basically how they got to the point to working on some of the coolest stuff you could imagine?
Yeah. I mean, so I actually come from the attack side of things. I did attack and pen forever back when Acuvant Labs was still around. They merged with Fishnet and became Optiv. But I have a lot of grandpa stories that I'm going to be sitting around in my rocking chair telling, right? A lot of fun stuff. And my team has those same stories, right? A lot of them, just kind of fell into security. Like I got my degree in psychology and philosophy. I just got sick of being a poor college student. I couldn't eat any more Top Ramen and Pop-Tarts, right? And so this is back in the early 90s. And there wasn't if you were in IT, you were just a computer guy, right? I think you guys remember, you just did whatever. It was building a web page. It was fixing a printer. It was whatever. You were the computer guy. And so now it's very easy and compartmentalized to be like, okay, I want to major in security, right? And you go through your CS classes and you do that. These folks all came up through the trade. They have 10 to 15 years of experience coming up through different either antivirus companies or different consulting firms. And it's really just like, I'm going to date myself here. It's kind of like the Bad News Bears all coming together and actually winning the championship.
I'm always here for a Bad News Bears reference, please.
Right. So it they came here and it's like family and they get to do all these cool things. And mm-hmm. So we separate the teams largely, it doesn't have to be broken down this way, but there's people who like to hunt and just find stuff. And just put it in the tip and just, keep digging in and finding these. And there's other people who like to take that and then massage that and find a larger meaning to that. Right. And so we've got kind of five or six on each side and they just go through and they just do that. Their background is mostly, in the industry. They've been researchers either at, other antivirus companies or consultants, but they've been doing this for a long, long time. And, their skills are off the chart. Right?
Wow. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'd like to bring this up. We bring this up often on the show. You mentioned, tech writers and also, your background in psychology and so forth. And I like to hammer that home all the time because I think a lot of people want to get into cybersecurity, but as you said, think of it as only being, code jockeys or script readers or whatever. And there's just different places where you can apply your talents. We had a computer forensics person on who said the best person on her team was a former psychologist because, if you're sitting here going through like 100,000 text messages, like you have to understand sort of like the mental game of that. And in this case, if you're sitting here finding interconnections between this data point and that data point or that piece of fine print, like you need really solid writing skills to like explain to other people what you found. So,
I love doing pen testing, but I hated writing the reports.
Right.
Right. But the report is actually the most important piece.
Yeah.
So, I would tell you, it's funny because I know that a lot of people are like, what skills do you need and this and that? But I'll be honest with you, like my motto is humble, hungry, and smart. Now I stole that from Patrick Lencioni. He's a writer that I really enjoy. But as you guys know, like some people have intangibles that you can't coach. Drive, determination, motivation. I can't make somebody more motivated to do this. Right. And so a lot of the people who work on this team, they fit in that. Like you don't need to tell them anything. They're excited to do this every single day. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we can teach you how to use tools and time will teach you to be better. But if you don't have kind of those base criteria at the beginning, it doesn't matter how well you know a tool or how, you're going to do what you feel you quote need to do. And then that might not be enough in a situation like this.
Yeah. Yeah. That sort of dog on a skateboard ferocity to sort of be answering questions every single day like that is going to get you a lot.
Yep. I'll be honest. I didn't mean to cut you off, Jack. I look at a lot of the work and I'm like, okay, this seems monotonous to me, right? That's my personality. To them, they love it. They don't care. Every day's a puzzle. It's a new thing.
Right.
They really don't care.
Accomplishment.
Yeah. So I'm like, all right, cool. Right. Like more power to you. I'm going to keep feeding you guys whatever you need. So
I mean, did you, before you sort of assembled your team here, were you working together on other projects, or did you sort of take these two particular sort of threat hunters based on sort of things they had done in the past or their reputation or whatever?
Normally it's whoever finds something, they run with it. Right.
Okay.
So, you know,
so they kind of brought it to you and said, hey, these things are happening. And you're like, all right, we're sort of putting this commission together now.
They usually just tell me, hey, this is what I'm working on. This is what I found. This is cool. This is what, okay. I don't guide them on that. Right.
Right.
I usually give them, you know, it's usually, hey, take 2 or 3 weeks. It, you know, just find something, pull on some strings, take 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. If you think it's got legs, just give me a briefing and then go handle what you need to handle. If you find out very quickly after that this is wasted time, stop and move on to the next one. I mean, that's the one thing is there's plenty out there in the world to be researched. So,
so kind of back to, you're talking about those intangible skills, you know, hungry, I forget exactly.
Humble, hungry, and smart.
Humble, hungry, and smart. You know, we hear this a lot from leaders in the cyber industry that, they're looking for those qualities. A question I always like to ask and find out is just, you know, if you were to advise another hiring manager or someone like that, how do you test for those skills in the interview process? I mean, obviously your first 90 days, you're going to know.
Sure.
But I mean,
how do you know before you hire them? Right?
Do you have any secrets you can share with the audience here on that?
I mean, the one thing I like to do is, it can't do it so much now in the COVID world, but go somewhere that's uncomfortable or just go for a walk somewhere that's crowded and things like that. Because as you guys know, so like, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area. So taking someone on a walk around Fisherman's Wharf in the middle of the day to do an interview, you're going to see how they react in a crowd. There's things that you will see that will be red flagged. I know it might seem weird, but when you see people out of their kind of ordinary, you see the person. Because by the time it gets to me, we already know they're technically qualified, and there's plenty of people we've turned down that are way better technically qualified, but we just don't think they're a cultural fit. And if they're not a cultural fit, I cannot stress enough, do not hire them. Just don't. Right. Yep. Give them that good feedback to adjust if but don't hire them if they're not a cultural fit. Like you said, 90 days later, you're going to be regretting it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Go ahead. Were you going to ask something?
No, Jack? No.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks.
Cool. Yeah. I want to sort of talk about the scope of Bahamut. Does this suggest anything for other threat groups in the future? I mean, this seems like a fairly large and unprecedented sort of threat actor. Does this level of ambition give future cyber espionage groups a working template to create from? Have you seen any sort of other groups that are sort of taking, you know, hints from this group and upping their game in that way?
I mean, yeah, they've definitely, right. If I was a bad guy, right. And I was looking for a measuring stick, they would definitely be that, or they could be that. But again, wanting and understanding, how execution is done, it's really the level. So I can watch how well you do a podcast. That doesn't mean I can go do it.
I was just going to say, just because you like Jordan doesn't mean you can dunk like Jordan. Yeah.
Right. But they've definitely laid out, you can look at them and see, I hate to use the term role model. That's not a good term. But, based on what we're talking about, but you can definitely see a path or a blueprint, as you stated, to follow. Again, I know I keep saying this, but the big thing is just their patience and their operational security is above what we normally see, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's state actor level. So again, I think, they've been trained in this. They could be ex-military, they could be something associated with that, but they really know what they're doing more than, most threat actors out there. And so I think we're going to continue to uncover things from them. But I do think, I think people will look at that, or people will leave that quote company and go start their own. Mm-hmm. Right. And it will be cut from the same cloth for sure.
So go ahead.
Sorry, just on specific attack just on specific tradecraft, the report mentions that like malware is kind of a last resort.
Yeah.
You know, it's really account takeovers and it's pivoting. Is this, in your opinion, is this the future, or is this kind of what all these threat actor groups are? This is the state of the art, where I guess if you can comment on kind of that methodology, like malware as last resort, and, you know, compare it to other things you see in the industry, and how you feel that's going to, you know, go out into the future. Yeah.
I mean, so they use, for the ones that we analyzed, right, there could be other projects out there that we don't know about where malware is key. But the ones that we looked at, and what this group is really good at is, and I think you can see it in the report, it's espionage and it's psychological operations, PSYOP stuff. So you don't necessarily need malware in all those cases, maybe to gain a foothold. But one of my specialties when I was a pen tester was spear phishing, just because it's easy, right? You send out 1,000 emails, you're going to get some stuff. Now, they didn't do that, obviously. They were highly targeted and against individuals that they knew would get them in, again, which shows another level of awareness of what their targets were and how to manipulate them or get access. In the White Company paper that we did, they used malware after they had already kind of done what they needed to do in a certain area. And if they wanted to pivot to a different area of the organization, so they set one side of the organization on fire as a diversion while they went and took over the other part and did what they needed to do over there. And so that was pretty interesting. I think there's an evolution of those types of things even outside of that. If you look at like even TrickBot, Emotet, Ryuk kind of combination, you know, it's okay, get information that will, you know, that someone's willing to pay for, and then ransom that box too, right? And I think that is going to continue to rise, because in the old days it was just they would ransom it, but now it's a whole campaign to get data, to have it, and then use that as a true ransom, you know, kind of leverage point. I do think that most campaigns of this nature, you know, they want to be stealthy, extremely stealthy, right? Yeah. They don't want to use malware. Those are the things. The longer you can stay in an environment undetected, obviously, the more you're going to find. Right. And so that is their goal in these campaigns. It's, you know, like I said earlier, mostly espionage, information gathering.
So, I mean, you know, you and your team are publishing a report against a very sophisticated PSYOPs espionage company. You know, I guess, how does that, like, what are your dinner conversations like at home? You know, it's like, you know, what did you do today, honey? Oh, yeah, you know, tell me about the personal aspect of working against Bahamut.
I mean, it's definitely a lot more interesting for my coworkers than my family. I've been, you know, kind of in this field for a while. So it's like, oh, hey, I took over XYZ casino today. Like, look, I've got access. And they're like, yeah, whatever, Dad. Right? Like, they just go, whatever, play their video games or shoot basketball or whatever. So they've heard all the stories for a decade. So to them, it's like, eh. But, you know, the one thing I can tell you is I've made sure that every child that I've had has had, you know, a computer or an iPad or something from like the age of 2 on. And I know a lot of probably psychologists would say that's really bad, and maybe it is, but guess what? Like, they're going to be the next generation, and they're going to be trained from the age of 2. So, you know, they think it's really interesting. They think it's exciting. They take coding classes and stuff now. So they get it. They get what Dad does, but, you know, and I don't want to compare myself again, but you brought up Jordan earlier, right? Like, I'm sure, like, you know, hey, Jordan would sit there and be like, I dumped 60 points today. And the kids would be like, thanks, Dad. That's awesome.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Just kind of walk away from the dinner table. It's the same situation, but I'm not Jordan, obviously, but yeah.
I mean, are you a target now though? I mean, they obviously know about the report. Like, do you feel like you're sort of in the crosshairs at all? Or is there anything that we're talking about? I mean, cause I'm sure they're going to hear this episode as well. Like, do you have any sort of safeguards in mind of like how not to sort of enable them by, you know, sort of giving things away or whatever?
I mean, you guys are like, you know, hey, you're poking the hornet's nest. Aren't you afraid of getting stung? Right. Yeah. I think that's what they do. That's what we do as researchers.
Right.
And I think that, you know, these groups feel the same way as well. I mean, that's why they have contingency plans. Do I feel like a target? I mean, I guess, right? Like we're out there. It's not hard to find out who I am.
Right.
But do I think they care about me specifically? No, I don't think so. I really don't. I think they have way bigger fish to fry. They probably have a lot of work on their plate. They want to go execute that.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they do this. Now, I don't want to downplay the relevance of the report. Obviously, the report is awesome, right? It's incredible what we're able to uncover. The good thing is that, you know, we're giving back to the community as all researchers should do. And hopefully this opens up more opportunities to further, potentially, taking them down if possible. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our job. That's what we do. We love doing it and we're going to continue to do that no matter what.
How much does this disrupt their operations? I mean, you know, everything you published is, you know, you've already taken all the actions against it. But I mean, like a summary report like this is like the CEO of Bahamut. Has he got like a dartboard with your face? You're saying that's probably not the situation. But I mean, you know, if someone disrupts BlackBerry's operations, right? Sure. Like, you know, executives are going to pay attention. Like they're going to try to, you know, take contingency plans or maybe strike back. I mean, how much do you think this hurts them?
I mean, obviously, whenever you disrupt any campaign, it hurts, right? And I think we did a good job of identifying several campaigns and bringing those to light, right? And we definitely have those conversations, right, at the office before we publish research like this. We tend to understand or try to understand the risks associated. We make sure that our operational security is a little bit more heightened and obviously put those checks and balances in place. So yeah, it's definitely a real thing. I do think we absolutely disrupted some of their activities. I'm sure they're not happy about that. And that absolutely could make the company potentially a target. But again, these are things that we try to cover the best of our abilities before we do anything like this. Right.
So the question from here, I guess you said a little bit about it, but what's to be done on a sort of macro or global counterterrorism level? How do we begin to neutralize groups like Bahamut?
Yeah, I mean it's really hard, especially if the group isn't under any type of, you know, U.S. law, at least for us. But sure. We definitely, as you know, like lots of agencies do work together, right? We work with different agencies to try to help provide guidance and help take things down. And if we're in a situation where we can provide that level of assistance, we're going to do it, right? And I think that these things take time. I think, what was it? Somebody sent me a link about the NotPetya. Like, we're finally raising, like, charges against them. It's been 3 years, wow. Right? So, and that was a single attack. So we're talking about a really sophisticated threat actor with multiple attacks, probably, you know, tons ongoing right now.
Sure.
Like I said, we're about to do some research that we believe is them as well. Right. So
imagine that's like any other sort of big trial case or whatever. Like if you're going to go after someone big, like the head of a mafia or whatever, like you need to have your case in order for a long time. Right.
Right. It's years. It's years of digging in. Cause again, we as researchers have some liberties, but law enforcement doesn't. They have to be absolutely sure with 100% certainty, right? And so that takes different levels of folks depending on what they're actually going after. And, you know, I mean, do we participate in any of that with the country where these folks might actually live and operate out of, right? That's also a concern. So,
okay. I mean, so to move from a macro level to the micro level, do you have any sort of lessons learned about what Bahamut does? It's sort of teaching us how we sort of teach security awareness or create security strategies, or, you know, since a lot of it is such, you know, sort of targeted against government officials and C-suites and things like that. Do you have any sort of takeaways from such a precise campaign like this?
Yeah, and it's going to be weird because it's going to be a very general response, which is cyber hygiene is real.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. You know, all those things that I think companies in the past have been lax about, you know, patching and doing things like that, or, hey, it's too difficult. Obviously, over the past few years, that's changed, and it's changed a lot with ransomware and,
yep,
and not the sophistication of the attack, but the ease of the attack. And so if you're not, you know, it doesn't matter how well your house is built if the foundation's crumbling. So you really have to, you know, if you're a CISO, you really have to understand, because, it, you know, as an attacker, they need one way in. You've got to defend against every single possibility. You know, that's why it's always so easy. And then when you add people into that equation, you're talking about thousands of entry points, right? Potentially. Now, in this case, they went after certain individuals. So I do think education is extremely important, but I also think that there should be technologies in place that even if somebody did, you know, was on your corporate network, clicked an email link, there's like five steps, you know, between the time someone clicks that link till a shell actually goes back to the command and control. And if you're not doing everything you can to protect against that, then, you know, you're making it easy. Right.
Right.
So I know that that's highly general, but I mean, that is really
still true.
That's what you can do. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and when we did attacks, like I said, I love to do spear phishing. But yeah, that's what I would always explain is there's like all these layers of security that you already have between here and there. So yeah, Tighten those up. Let's take a look and see what we can do there.
How do you feel about, like, just in general frameworks like MITRE ATT&CK or like SHIELD or things like that as a framework for companies to help them, you know, stop these type of attacks or put the right defenses in place? Like what role do you think those frameworks play in an active defense?
I mean, I think they're important. I think they're important from taking something that's ethereal and making it tangible and helping guide people. But I think more importantly is, and I experienced this a lot as an on the attack side, was most companies don't understand their gaps. So you have to understand your gaps before you can look at those frameworks and start applying what you need, right? I guess you can look at some. I mean, if we took everything in MITRE and then went and looked at our company, we would probably find a lot of holes. But then you also have to prioritize what is the real risk of the company. You know, what are we doing? And I think that understanding those concepts is probably still a little distant for a lot of organizations, right? What it actually means and what that actual risk is. You know, and I'm thinking of places where, you know, maybe the security personnel are more junior in learning, right? They might not be able to, the old days, you know, if you ran Nessus, you can take a Nessus report and it'd be like, you know, SSL V2 critical, right? It's like, well, is it?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what's the possibility of that? And I think there's still a lot of that in our industry, right? A lot of learning that's going on. So I think that companies need to understand what they believe is the true risk, or listen to those personnel that will help them understand the true risk, and then start applying those kind of methodologies and frameworks to tighten things up.
So do you think, like, framework-based cybersecurity programs, do you think it's helping or hurting? I mean, you've been in the industry for a long time.
I mean, anything that brings awareness is helpful. It's having the individuals that understand, again, like, this came up, is this a true risk? How does this attack really work? Is this something that would really work against us, right? I mean, things like patching is easy, right? Like, as far as understanding, okay, I need to patch this. This is a vulnerability, I need to patch this. But when you look at something like, you know, they have automated pen testing, it's kind of getting really big, right? Where we can remove a person from that. I think that those things are important, but if your automation or if your framework or whatever it is requires you to start as admin on a laptop with passwords, you're, you know, that's already I'm not going to say a completely unreal situation, but it's a lot different than going in and dropping a device and having nothing and then pivoting around, right? Which is also plausible. But I do think anything that brings awareness is helpful. Again, it takes a person to understand this is a priority and this is what we need to work on from a top-down perspective. And I don't know that that's always, I don't know that that expertise is always there.
Right. Yeah, good perspective. Thanks.
Yeah.
So I think we've sort of already, you said that a lot of what you sort of learned and did was not particularly, you know, cloak and dagger oriented or surprising, but were there any unusual or out of the box strategies or tactics that your team used to put together the facts for this report? Or is there any sort of like surprises where someone took a big chance and found something really unusual?
Not really, but I think that's a good thing, right? That means that other researchers can repeat these steps,
right?
Can look and find more, right? We are in no way saying that we found everything, right?
Of course.
The victim list and all those things that we found, obviously there's more out there. Mm-hmm. So the good thing is anybody, you know, who's already looking into them, hopefully can take the breadcrumbs that we left, can pull on additional strings, can say, hey, it doesn't look like they tried this, or I'm going to go do these different things and build upon it. And right, as you guys know, that's what research is, right? It's just like research in any other industry. We do our best. We present everything we have, and we hope that somebody can take that and carry it farther. And then maybe we'll come back around for round three, right?
Yeah.
When we find more.
So. Do you feel sort of changed or leveled up at all as a researcher of doing this? Was this an especially sort of like massive project for you that sort of turned a corner for you in any way?
For the team, I think so, right? Like anytime you go look at these types of things, you're going to level up, right? Mm-hmm. I think the way I would say it is, you know, you touched on it earlier, like the boss level is taking them down. Right. And so we're another step closer to that boss level. But definitely anything that's going to expand what you know and take you further is helpful. And it's really interesting. We talked earlier about just the psychology of these groups and how they work. Not always just their toolkit, but just how they go about executing is pretty fascinating, at least to me.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's cool. I guess one thing we haven't really touched on that I want to make sure we cover is the leveraging the App Store and apps. There were like 9 iOS apps that you were able to attribute to that. I guess what do you make of this strategy around apps? And you know, it seems like a broad stroke. It seems like the very opposite of spearfishing to me. And like, what does that tell you about like their capabilities or maybe their end customer?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the apps were developed after they had some type of understanding of who they were going after and what they were looking to get. I know that and they were also limited to certain regions, right? So they knew who they were going after. The most interesting thing about the apps, at least that I found the most interesting, was their successful use of EULAs, and they had pristine websites explaining it. Like I mentioned earlier, like they explained everything that they were going to do in those apps, but the people who installed them didn't understand that by giving away certain level of privileges that it opened them up to potentially access to different things. Like the password saver is one that we call out, where it's like, hey, we'll be your password saver. So we're the ones that's encrypting all of your data. Wow. Put your passwords in here, right? And so now we have access to all the data. Like, obviously, that's super smart, right? That's something that's pretty interesting. But yeah, just the way that they were able to properly leverage the app stores to get their apps there wasn't, in at least the iOS ones, there wasn't anything like malicious necessarily in the app. It was more of a, how did I put this when I was explaining it before? It was like, it's social engineering. So it was more of like, I would say phone privilege abuse, right? More than anything else. Yeah. But the person's giving away that level of privilege. So again, that goes back to the whole education thing.
Yeah.
We live on our phones all day. As they say, it's the first thing we see in the morning and the last thing we see before we close our eyes for bed. So I think mobile apps is, you know, that's the way to get people. And like I said, I've got five kids total, four at home, and they're all on apps all the time. Right. And I have to, constantly say, nope, you can't download this. You can't do that. Right. And I put them on the guest network too, just in case. So
you segment yourself from the
kids. Right.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty smart.
Yeah. So no IoT devices, my whole separate thing for IoT, because those will probably also be the first thing owned once the apps get owned. But it's interesting. I think we're going to continue to see more of that. I mean, that's where we live nowadays, right?
Right. So.
What advice would you give to companies to prevent their employees from falling for these fake app? I mean, you know, Chris's phone's not owned by InfoSec. My phone's not owned by InfoSec. But how do you protect the personal side of it, where, you know, you can see that's the leverage point now, right? Like you can buy on the dark web, you can buy Facebook accounts for $1, Netflix accounts for $1.
Sure.
I mean, you know, to get onto, a server or something at a major Fortune 500 company, cost you millions of dollars in research in 0 day. So, that's where it's going. Like what do you think companies should be doing today?
I mean, if I was taking a hard line, I would basically say that, you can't use your personal phone for work, right? I know that might not be the straightforward thing, but, at BlackBerry, we do have that. We have, we can get a company-owned phone to do company stuff. We can do BYOD, but we also have apps that we've created that containerize everything. And so I think those types of security products will continue to come out, because necessity is the mother of invention, right? And I think the whole, looking at opportunities to containerize a work environment from a personal environment is probably going to continue to grow and do that. So, I guess what I'm saying is you can't necessarily trust the people, and I wouldn't say it's the people's fault. Right. Again, if you look at what we put in the report, like it's hard to understand that those apps aren't real. It's hard to understand based on not just the app being in the Play Store, but the story that they put behind it. Right. And you guys mentioned the fake empire, and I didn't really touch on it, but the fact that they had accounts consistently messaging and adding content and all those types of things, like, when you're up against a sophisticated threat actor, the people are going to be the weakest link, but it might not always be their fault. And we used to explain also, like, when we do pen testing and maybe when we did social engineering, it was, if I send a PDF to HR and they open it, it's not HR's fault because that's their job, right? Their job is to go do these things. It's your job to protect them in case something comes in, right?
Right.
And so I think that, like I said earlier, those types of technologies continue to grow. I think containerization is going to be something that's going to be big.
Mm-hmm.
Zero trust, right? Zero trust across the board. That's the buzzword. So, yeah.
So we're bumping up on an hour here, and so we want to let you go. But I wanted to kind of wrap it up. We always want to sort of tie things back to the work of cybersecurity, cyber work. And I just wanted to sort of wrap up by asking again. We talked a little bit about the fact that you can teach tools, you can teach processes, but you can't teach obsession, you can't teach problem solving. But still to that area for people who are just starting now and sort of want to move on a track towards this type of threat hunting and this type of threat intelligence, what types of like skills or projects or areas of study, or what should they be working on now that sort of like moves them on that path, even if they're not necessarily doing that as a job at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, so the one thing that at least stands out for me, cause I didn't have a CS background, is I couldn't code. I still can't. Mm-hmm. Right. I've written a lot of things in Bash, but learning Python, learning Ruby, understanding, how to do that is going to help you out in a million different situations, right? That's like a Swiss Army knife. Data science is also getting to be pretty big. Obviously, we're a data science company. You know, I'm into research intelligence, and we do a lot of ML model creation. I think having some understanding of that might help a bit. But yeah, I think the coding. I guess I would also say if you know how to fix a network. So if you're a network admin or a sysadmin of some kind, and you know how to bring back systems from the dead that have been attacked or networks, like those are the types of skills that will greatly benefit you here. IR is another great skill. It's really like being able to analyze, understand what's going on and reverse those things that have been done. So I think those are probably, they might not seem like, you know, a direct tie-in, but you're solving a problem. And when you do these types of research things, you're also solving a problem and trying to find out everything that's going on. And you know, like I said earlier, kind of pull on all those strings. So I think that those types of kind of general criteria, I think, would be extremely beneficial for anybody who wants to get in the field.
Cool. Jack, yeah. You have any rapid questions you want to ask?
No, you know, Eric, I just really want to thank you for taking some time speaking with us. And I know you're super busy thwarting all sorts of evil out there in the world. So really appreciate it coming on the podcast. And, you know, really look forward to future things that you're going to be publishing. You mentioned you got something else coming out in the future. Any other, I guess, last question is any other things we should look forward from BlackBerry that we should point our audience to stay up to date or to learn more about things that are going to be coming out?
Yeah. I mean, so we have obviously a blog site, Threat Vector, and in the next couple of weeks we have another Hack for Hire coming up, report coming up, we believe is tied to Bahamut. Also we have a lot of great webinars that come out of the research intelligence team. So,
okay. Where can people find those? Do you have like a website or a link or something you want to suggest?
You know what? I if you do a search for Threat Vector and BlackBerry, okay.
Great.
That'll take you to a lot of stuff. And we do a lot of different things there. You know, whatever's a kind of in the news and what's affecting our customers, we try to do more consistently. Obviously, this type of research takes months to put together, so we'll do that. But yeah, we try to be out there with all those nonstop, so everybody knows the kind of coolness that we're working on.
Do you have any social media links you want to share? Do you LinkedIn? Do you tweet?
So LinkedIn, I'm just Eric Milam. Mm-hmm. I think Eric.Milam on LinkedIn.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a BlackBerry LinkedIn. I got to admit, I kind of gave up all social media back when I was a pen tester.
Makes sense.
You know, I was like, okay, I think it's time to move on from this. But every once in a while, I'll tweet, and that's Bravo Hacks.
Okay.
My old moniker out there. So, yeah.
Cool. Jack, anything you want to share about?
No. Just thanks. Yeah, great, cool. Great episode. So,
yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. This is a good time.
Thank you so much, Eric, and thank you, Jack, as well, for joining us.
Thank you.
Sounds good.
CyberWork with InfoSec is produced weekly by InfoSec and is aimed at cybersecurity professionals and those who wish to enter the cybersecurity field. New episodes of CyberWork are released every Monday on our YouTube channel and on all podcast platforms. Just type in CyberWork with InfoSec on YouTube and you'll find it. And if you do the same on whatever you get podcasts on, you will find us. If you want to claim one free month of our InfoSec skills platform, please visit InfoSecInstitute.com/skills. And enter the promo code CyberWork, all one word, all small letters. You'll get a free month of security courses, hands-on cyber ranges, skills assessments, and certification practice exams for you to try. Thanks once again to Eric Milam and Jack Koziel, and thank you all for watching and listening. We will speak to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to InfoSecInstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to InfoSecInstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.